Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for a really strange one. We're exploring a place that promised the ultimate escape.
Mm-hmm.
But what it delivered was something much, much closer to total permanent control.
That's right. We're looking at the bizarre, legally autonomous, and frankly, deeply unsettling history of Wonderworld.
And its founder, visionary isn't quite the right word. Maybe the terrifying visionary, Elias Frost.
It's one of the most fascinating case studies we've ever come across in our sources. You look at it, and on the surface, it's just this famous resort destination, right? Known for its cheerful, nonstop spectacle.
Yeah, the happiest place on Earth, or so they say.
But when you start reading the fine print, and I mean really digging into the operational notes and the legal documents, you realize this wasn't built as a park for people. It was a system that was powered by them.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the sources we have, these articles and excerpts detailing the true nature of Wonderworld, they all start with this one provocative legal absurdity that just demands your attention immediately.
It's the perfect hook.
It is. We have to start with this question. Why is it illegal, or at the very least legally impossible, to be declared dead inside the gates of the most magical place on Earth?
And that one specific legal detail, it's the entire story compressed into a single bizarre rule. The answer is that Elias Frost didn't just build a successful company. He built a closed-loop reality.
A reality where some things just weren't allowed.
Exactly. And in that reality, the finality of human life, specifically death, was simply not permitted to exist within his jurisdiction.
So let's set the scene. Wonderworld opens with all this fanfare in 1971. It's right in the heart of the Central Florida swamps, which already feels like a statement, you know, an attempt to conquer nature.
Right, building a perfect city on top of a swamp.
And it's presented to the public as this standard, joyful family resort. But we're immediately introduced to Elias Frost, the visionary behind it all. And his vision wasn't about selling tickets. It was about selling permanence.
When we look at Frost, we really have to see him as a man whose ambition just. It vastly exceeded the theme park industry. He wasn't interested in temporary entertainment. He wanted to engineer a sustainable utopia, or maybe more accurately, a perfectly managed microstate.
So that's our mission today. We're diving into the specifics of these sources to understand how Wonderworld transformed from a theme park into the sovereign microstate built on a terrifying vision of control. We need to see how the magic was engineered, what legal gymnastics made it possible,
and what the real physical and even biological cost of that engineering truly was.
Okay, let's jump straight into the groundwork, because this is where the magic becomes, well, a mandate. Frost wasn't just building a resort. He was laying the foundation for an independent country.
We have to focus on this dual identity. Publicly, it's a resort. It's about hospitality. But secretly, Frost constructed it as a sovereign state with its own laws, its own operational framework.
And this wasn't an accident.
Oh, not at all. This was a result of years of strategic land acquisition and some very, very clever legislative maneuvering.
But how does someone even do that? How do you achieve that level of sovereignty inside the United States? It sounds like something from a spy movie, not a zoning meeting.
Well, the sources suggest he leveraged economic incentives. It's actually pretty brilliant in a scary way. Frost basically pitched the local and state governments on the immense financial gain, tourism, jobs, tax revenue that Wonderworld would bring.
In return,
he demanded unprecedented autonomy. It usually manifests as these special governmental districts that essentially grant the developer sweeping powers, the ability to issue their own bonds, create their own infrastructure, enforce their own codes.
Or crucially, to write regulations that supersede typical county jurisdiction.
Precisely. So he didn't secede from the union. He just bought a massive legal loophole. He used the promise of magic, that economic engine, as camouflage.
And that lets him contrast this advertised joy and fantasy with a hidden set of rules that govern every single aspect of the space, especially the staff and, well, the movement of the guests.
It's the ultimate power move disguised as urban planning. He convinced the state that only he could properly manage the complex infrastructure of Wonderworld. And therefore, he needed total control to ensure the magic was never broken by outside realities like building codes or, as we discover later, judicial interference.
So the moment you walk through those gates...
The moment you step through those whimsical gates, you are unknowingly consenting to Frost's framework. You think you're paying for a ticket and a hotel. What you're actually doing is entering a jurisdiction where Elias Frost is the ultimate authority.
It fundamentally changes the definition of hospitality. It stops being about serving guests and starts being about managing a population.
Yes. The legal structure itself exists to protect the park's narrative above the comfort or even the safety of the individual visitor.
And this need for total, legally guaranteed control was all driven by his life's work, the thing he called the Tomorrow Project.
That name is so deliberately misleading.
It is. It sounds like, you know, forward-thinking city design.
Right.
Sustainable living, maybe some driverless cars. But the reality of this prototype city, built secretly inside the park, was, well, it was far more demanding on its citizens.
The documents we have detailing the Tomorrow Project are just chillingly specific. Frost's goal was literal endless perfection.
Mm.
And the criteria for his ideal residence, get this, was that they would never age, never sleep, and never leave.
Never age, never sleep, and never leave. I mean,
yeah.
If you take the human element out of that, you're describing a machine, a perfectly maintained animatronic.
That's it, exactly. That's not a utopian lifestyle. That's perpetual utility. It's enforced spaces.
Why, though? What's the practical reason for that?
Well, think about it from his perspective. If residents never age, the physical structures of the city and the whole aesthetic illusion, they never deteriorate. They never require costly updates. If they never sleep, the park can operate 24/7, maximizing efficiency and immersion.
And if they never leave?
The audience is always captive, always there, always applauding.
The sources make the analysis of his goal crystal clear. He didn't want repeat customers who might eventually get bored.
No. He wanted a permanent audience that formed an essential, non-degradable component of the infrastructure itself. The people, in his mind, were just another resource, like water or electricity, that needed to be managed for maximum output.
And that explains the need for legal sovereignty. A regular city has to accommodate change. People are born, people die, they move, laws evolve.
The Tomorrow Project could tolerate none of that. To achieve this level of permanent stasis, Frost needed the legal power to define human life, or the lack thereof, on his own terms.
Which brings us back to that first question.
Exactly. It all connects. If we link this hidden governance structure to the broader theme of systems control, it's a perfect illustration of that principle highlighted in the Disney World Controlled Zone source. Control hides best in plain sight.
Let's spend a bit more time on that phrase, because I think it's key.
Yeah.
How does that work in practice at Wonderworld? Most people think of control as, you know, visible barriers. Fences, guards, cameras everywhere.
Here, the control is built into the sensory experience itself. It's acoustic control. The music is designed to be perpetually cheerful, repetitive, discouraging, sustained negative thought. It's visual control. Everything is manicured and colorful, overwhelming any sense of decay or disorder.
And legally, the control is hidden in the fine print on the ticket you bought or in the employment contract you signed.
It's a Trojan horse using happiness as the disguise. By seeking out the joy and the fantasy, guests are actively submitting to an environment that is simultaneously managing them. Frost weaponized family fun to embed this radical legal and social engineering.
And that is why the whole sovereignty over hospitality thing is so crucial. Hospitality is about anticipating and fulfilling a guest's desires.
But sovereignty is about defining and enforcing behavior upon a subject. And once Frost crossed that line, any guest who was unhappy or non-compliant wasn't just a dissatisfied customer who needed a refund. They were a systemic threat to the entire operation.
If the guests stop smiling, they threaten the narrative of perpetual happiness that legitimizes the microstate.
And that's an emergency. An emergency that requires immediate, discreet, and non-public resolution.
Which means the system needs physical enforcement mechanisms that are just as hidden as the legal framework. This brings us, literally... to the dark infrastructure beneath the magic.
Right, we have to go underground.
Now we move beneath the surface. Because the successful enforcement of Frost's vision required a vast, hidden infrastructure, both architectural and, terrifyingly, biological.
The utilidors are maybe the most famous or infamous part of the park's engineering. We're talking about a massive underground network, basically a subterranean city constructed directly beneath the main park.
And when Frost was asked about these tunnels by the press, he had this perfectly rational, practical explanation ready to go. It was all designed to maintain the illusion on the surface.
Right. He said they were solely for moving trash, supplies, and staff out of sight. You know, ensuring guests never saw a costumed character walking from one themed land to another, it preserves the magic.
That was the official line, the public story.
But the workers who spent their shifts down there, the people who actually lived in this hidden architecture, they circulated a much darker truth. And our sources confirm this. Workers whispered that the tunnels were really for moving unhappy guests who stopped smiling.
That detail. It just shifts the entire purpose of the design from logistical efficiency to emotional enforcement. Let's think about the logistics of that claim. If happiness is mandatory, how large and complex would the system need to be?
To make sure any guest who breaks character, throws a tantrum, has an anxiety attack, experiences any genuine distress, is immediately and discreetly removed from the visible layer of reality.
It's a huge operation.
The tunnels function like a systemic digestive tract. If the surface is the pristine face of the state, the tunnels handle the waste, both physical trash and, well, emotional noncompliance. The architectural control is absolute.
You need hidden entrances near all the major attractions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rapid response teams trained not in first aid or customer service, but in discreet extraction.
Exactly. This suggests that the staff in the utilidors weren't just maintenance crew. They were the enforcement arm of the sovereign state. If they were seen bringing a struggling, unhappy family into the tunnels, that would break the illusion above ground.
So the whole operation had to be fast, silent, seamless.
The tunnels were necessary because the system could not tolerate disruption. Any moment of genuine human reality, sadness, anger, frustration, was deemed a dangerous pollutant to the Tomorrow Project.
And the lie claiming they were for trash was genius. It gives the tunnels a banal, forgettable purpose. No one asks questions about where the garbage goes.
They're the circulatory system for systemic rejection. They ensure that once a negative experience is identified, it is permanently contained and removed from the surface narrative.
The intensity of Frost's commitment to this illusion is just. It's exemplified by his almost manic obsession with aesthetic detail, which led to the next and, frankly, horrific phase of control. His war on anything that looked fake.
This is such a strangely specific detail, but it speaks volumes about his psychology. Frost absolutely hated visible seams, zippers, and bulky costume heads. For a man obsessed with a permanent, seamless reality, a zipper was a sign of temporality. It's a thing that can be put on and taken off, revealing the actor underneath.
And if the actor is revealed, the entire fantasy collapses. The permanence is shattered.
In Frost's mind, if the experience is meant to be eternal, the characters must be eternally real, too. An actor sweating inside a polyester suit was an unforgivable imperfection that risked exposing the whole mechanism.
This aesthetic obsession creates a huge technical challenge. How do you create hyper-realistic characters that never age, never tire, and can never remove their costumes because, well, there are no costumes?
And this is where Frost makes that critical, horrifying leap from architectural engineering to biological engineering.
So if you can't have actors in suits and you must have perpetually perfect characters roaming the park, you need a radical solution for creating realistic, seamless character appearances that are permanent.
Which brings us to probably the most disturbing character in this whole story, Dr. Howard.
Right. We meet Dr. Howard, the strange geneticist Frost brought in to solve the zipper problem.
And the source material often lingers on this bizarre personal detail about him. He was distinctly noted for his duck-like waddle. It's this small, almost comical detail that sits in shocking contrast to the gravity of his work.
The contrast is jarring, the waddle in the high-level dark science. But his mandate from Frost was brutally simple. Solve the costume problem by splicing animal DNA with park staff.
This wasn't some subtle genetic therapy. This was crude, targeted biomutation, all in the service of visual perfection. The sources imply that Frost viewed his staff not as employees deserving of labor protection, but as customizable raw material, mutable to the park's aesthetic needs.
Dr. Howard's job was to ensure the character was the employee.
The implications for the staff are just staggering. They were permanently altered.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet.
Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Into the park's performance. The shocking result was that the mascots roaming the park were not actors taking a break down in the utilidors.
They were permanent mutations wearing gloves.
And we have to highlight the most vivid example, the 6-foot mouse leading the parade. This iconic figure, beloved by families, was the embodiment of this horror. The key phrase from the source material is one that just sticks with you. That wasn't a mask, that was a mutation.
The cognitive dissonance of that.
Yeah.
Waving at this cheerful figure, knowing that it's a genetically re-engineered former human being.
Yeah.
It's almost unbearable. Okay, let's explore the gloves for a moment. Why the gloves? If the body and face were mutated for permanent character realism, what's the deal with the gloves?
I think the gloves served a dual purpose. First, practical. Hands and fingers, with all their complexity and sensitivity, would have been the hardest parts of the human form to aesthetically mutate cleanly without losing functionality.
Okay, that makes sense.
And second, they maintained the stylized iconography of the characters. So they weren't wearing suits, they were simply wearing accessories that complemented their new, permanent biological form. It was a finishing touch on an act of absolute dehumanization.
This ethical leap is the point of no return for Froth's vision. We've moved from hiding dissatisfaction architecturally in tunnels to permanently altering the human form biologically, purely to satisfy the aesthetic demands of a founder who hated zippers.
It just shows that in Wonderworld, the illusion must be maintained, no matter the cost to human integrity. And this commitment to biological control demonstrates the logical endpoint of the Tomorrow Project. If the audience is permanent, the performers must be permanent, too.
The spectacle must never cease, and the actors must never retire, shed their costumes, or even look slightly less than perfect.
And any system built on that kind of total stasis and absolute perfection, it's inherently fragile, because reality eventually exerts its pressure.
For Wonderworld, the system experienced a catastrophic failure, a glitch, and the sources even anchor it to an impossible date.
Right. We look at the records surrounding the system failure, and we anchor the event to the non-existent impossible date of February 30th.
Which is symbolic in itself. It suggests the system was operating outside the bounds of conventional time and reality, built on a promise that mathematically couldn't be kept.
And on this non-date, we have the monorail incident. The monorail, this symbol of futuristic, efficient transportation, just halts, dead, over the lagoon. Passengers are trapped. Suspended.
The initial reports would have surely pointed to a mechanical failure, right? A brownout, something simple. But the source documents deny this.
No. The cause was not a typical mechanical failure. The true cause reveals the terrifying underbelly of Wonderworld's energy demands. The monorail was actively harvesting bioenergy from the passengers to power the castle lights.
Bioenergy harvesting. Okay, this concept needs a deeper look. The castle, the majestic symbol of magic, was actually a massive energy siphon. What mechanisms did the sources suggest were in play here? How does a monorail harvest bioenergy from its passengers?
The notes speculate on a few methods, all centered on subtle, constant extraction. One theory suggests the seats and floorboards were lined with advanced piezoelectric materials, converting the smallest vibrations, pressure changes, body heat, all that kinetic and thermal energy into electricity.
And there was a darker theory.
A darker one involved localized acoustic harvesting, utilizing the subconscious vibrations of human voices and even internal movements, which would explain why the background music in the cars was often described as being slightly too low frequency.
That is the ultimate twist on the price of magic. The system didn't just require eternal happiness and perpetual presence. It required active energy extraction from the patrons to sustain the illusion.
The guests were literally paying the electric bill with their life force. Frost required total energy independence, and if natural resources weren't enough, he treated the audience as a rechargeable battery.
And the stress of this harvesting, the drain on the system, is what caused the monorail to seize up over the lagoon. It exposed the entire operation. It turned a symbol of transport into a symbol of systematic theft.
And as the monorail incident was unfolding, exposing this power drain, a direct and desperate warning emerged from another core attraction. It suggested the system itself was fracturing under the stress.
The Hall of Presidents horror.
Guests are watching the historical figures and they stop their rehearsed speeches about freedom and democracy. They stand still. An eerie silence falls over the hall.
But they didn't stay silent. The animatronics began blinking. and a specific rhythmic pattern.
They were communicating in Morse code. This is so significant. It's not a random error. It's programmed communication.
Which raises the critical question, was this a spontaneous failure? Was it the system's own AI recognizing the danger and trying to warn its captives?
Or was this a deeply embedded hidden failsafe designed by a sympathetic programmer who understood the horror of Frost's ultimate plans and wanted a way out?
Either way, the message was stripped down to the simplest, most urgent phrase possible for anyone who could decipher the blinking lights.
Get out!
It's an instruction for survival. A moment where the performers betrayed the core philosophy of the park perpetual stasis to urge the audience to escape. The system was screaming its own limits.
And this public exposure, coupled with the trapped monorail full of bioenergy harvested passengers, this is what finally triggered an intervention from outside the sovereign jurisdiction.
The official response comes swiftly. Despite Frost's legal sovereignty, the severity of the incidents, the energy theft, the trapped tourists, the public warning, it forced the FBI to intervene. They raided a place called Club 33.
And Club 33 is significant because it was identified as a secret lounge behind a hidden fake door in a quiet corner of the park. Even the federal agents had to navigate the inherent secrecy and spatial trickery of the microstate just to access the founder's operational center.
It's the perfect metaphor for Frost's entire operation. An exclusive hidden core where the real business was conducted. The planning, the legal strategy, the dark science, all shielded from the public eye.
And what the FBI discovers inside is the final, definitive proof of Elias Frost's absolute commitment to his own tomorrow project ideology.
When the agents breach the club, they find Elias Frost sitting calmly beside a massive cryogenic tank. You'd expect a control panel, maybe escape plans.
But the focus is immediately drawn to the tank's contents.
And the contents of the tank were not resources or plans or weapons. It contained his own head, frozen in a permanent smile.
The sources describe it with this particularly disturbing visual detail, noting it looked like an ice cream, because of how the preservation materials had colored the ice.
This wasn't standard cryogenic preservation for future revival. This was a grotesque, highly aesthetic commitment to the park's central mandate, permanence and constant happiness. He had achieved his personal version of the Tomorrow Project, a perpetually preserved, perpetually smiling face waiting for the future.
It confirms that for Frost, the body was just a temporary vessel. Only the aesthetic symbol, the permanent smile, was worthy of preservation.
And then, the finale, the escape attempt. As the FBI is securing the premises, Frost, in a final act of theatrical defiance, bolts. He tries to escape on a roller coaster. You'd assume it leads to a secret exit, a safe house.
But the sources are clear. The track did not lead back to a station. In a final piece of self-destructive engineering, Frost had designed that specific ride as a one-way trip.
He ended abruptly. It led straight into the swamp.
Disappearing back into the same central Florida wetlands where the park began. A perfect, dramatic, and ambiguous end for a man who tried to conquer reality, only to be swallowed by it.
You'd think that would be the end of it.
You would. But despite the FBI raid, the energy harvesting scandal, the animatronic warning, and the founder vanishing into a swamp, the source has confirmed something deeply troubling about Wonderworld's resilience. The system proved far more durable than its mad creator.
The park never truly closes. It continues to operate decades later, serving millions who are likely completely unaware of its foundational horrors. It just maintains that veneer of perpetual magic.
But the legal framework that Frost engineered, that sovereign microstate identity, that's the key to its continued operation. So we come back to our opening question and the key legal change that was made.
Right. The official language was quietly altered so that no one can be officially declared dead inside the park.
This is the legal manifestation of the Tomorrow Project's denial of failure. The park, through its retained sovereignty, refuses to acknowledge human mortality within its gates. It cannot allow the ultimate reality death to rupture the illusion of eternal life that it sells.
And think about the logistical nightmare this creates for outside authorities. If a visitor suffers a fatal medical incident inside Wonderworld, law enforcement, county medical examiners, insurance companies, they're powerless to intervene directly because of the park's jurisdictional claim.
So what happened?
Instead of a formal process with police and coroners, the protocol is chillingly clinical. Families are simply escorted out of the gates, and the individual is only declared deceased once they cross the sovereign boundary and enter county jurisdiction.
So the park maintains its narrative of eternal life by outsourcing the messy administrative reality of death. It forces the problem onto the outside world.
It's the ultimate legal loophole. The park can truthfully say, death never happens here, because they have legally defined it as an event that must occur elsewhere.
And the disturbing biological legacy of Dr. Howard's work that remains subtly visible today, even in the park's most innocent and beloved attractions.
We have to look at the small world-style boat ride, a fixture in so many parks, right? Famous for its rows of animated dolls singing those perpetual, cheerful songs.
But the specific detail is insidious because it's so easy to miss amidst all the bright lights and sound.
If you stare long enough at the dolls, especially the ones positioned close to the riders, you'll notice they have disturbingly human teeth, not painted plastic teeth. Hyper-realistic, structurally accurate molars and incisors.
And this detail connects directly back to the genetic experiments of Act Two. It suggests that the aesthetic perfection demanded by Frost still relies on unsettling human elements hidden in plain sight. Were these teeth harvested? Were they a byproduct of the mutation experiments?
The sources just raise the implication that even if Dr. Howard is gone, the pursuit of biological realism continues. It's a chilling reminder that the park uses real, unsettling human components to enhance its illusion.
It makes you wonder if the dolls are just a shell. And the realism, the perpetual smiling, is being maintained by something far more complex than fiberglass and hydraulics.
It ensures the horror isn't just confined to the founder's lair or the hidden tunnels. It's right there, singing cheerily, built into the very fabric of the most mundane attractions.
And all of these operational failures, legal contortions, and biological secrets, they're perfectly captured and marketed in the park's enduring, terrifying slogan.
Let's reiterate it. At Wonderworld, the magic doesn't end, and neither do you.
It's an act of psychological genius, because it promises what every person desires, eternity. But it defines that eternity on Frost's terms. It perfectly encapsulates his obsession with permanence.
When Frost promised that you would not end, he didn't mean you would ascend to a glorious afterlife or live a long, satisfying life.
He meant you would be a permanent fixture, an essential, non-aging, non-sleeping audience member. Or maybe an energy source for his endless show.
The slogan implies eternal joy, but what the sources reveal is a promise of eternal stasis. Or really, eternal captivity. It strips away personal autonomy and replaces it with forced permanence. It's the ultimate contractual surrender.
And that, ultimately, is the cost of the magic.
And that's about the deepest dive we can take into the bizarre, legally autonomous, and biologically warped history of Wonderworld and Elias Frost's horrifying vision. It's a story of a man who used the promise of happiness to establish total, unchallenged governance.
So the synthesized insight we leave you with today has to be this. Some places promise magic forever, but they forget to mention what forever costs.
The price, in the case of Elias Frost's vision, was the surrender of legal rights, architectural surveillance of emotion, the integrity of the human form, and ultimately the very freedom to experience a natural end to life.
Given that Frost's obsession was to create a place where residents never leave and never sleep, and the fact that the system is still running, robust, and seemingly perfect decades after his escape, this raises an important question for you, the listener.
What specific non-visible systems do you think are still running beneath the park today, ensuring the audience remains permanent and the magic never ends?
Are they still optimizing the energy harvesting to avoid another February 30th incident? Are the utilidors still actively moving non-compliant guests?
Or has Dr. Howard's biological legacy, perhaps, found a way to create characters that require even less upkeep than the genetically spliced staff?
Something to mull over the next time you hear a cheerful, repetitive song coming from a small boat ride.
And you find yourself wondering about the source of those perfectly aligned, unnervingly human teeth.
For the full breakdown of all the source notes and more deep dives into family attractions gone wrong, you can find our analysis and sources at Inspector Story. Thanks for diving deep with us.
We'll see you next time.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.